Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's the last season of baseball for Yankee Stadium as we've known it. Many a game gone by and a lot of ghosts up in the Bronx of greats like Babe Ruth, Vicky Mantle, and Joe DiMaggio, not to mention legendary voices. Here's longtime Yankees announcer Red Barber, who at the time announced for the Brooklyn Dodgers, calling Game 6 of the 1947 World Series at Yankee Stadium. Joe DiMaggio is batter up.
Joe leans in. Outfield deep, round toward left, the infield overshifted. Here's the pitch. Swung on, belted. It's a long one. Deep into left center. Back for Gianfrido. Back. He makes a one-handed catch against the bullpen. Oh, doctor.
Back. This hour, On Point, we're talking about the end of Yankee Stadium, Shea Stadium, too, and how the world of ballparks and baseball is changing. With us today from Port Washington, New York, is George Vesey. He's sports columnist for the New York Times and author of Baseball, A History of America's Favorite Game. George, welcome back.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very well, thanks. From Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, we're joined by Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics who knows his baseball economics. He's the author of The Bottom Line, Observations and Arguments on the Sports Business, and many more titles. Andrew Zimbalist, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
And from South Bend, Indiana, Philip Bess is here. He's professor of architecture at Notre Dame, author of City Baseball Magic, Plain Talk and Uncommon Sense About Cities and Baseball Parks. Professor Bess, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
George, first to you. You said you've already told your readers this week in the New York Times, brace yourself. There's going to be so much nostalgia about this park. It's going to be lush and treacly nostalgia. We don't want to go there. On the other hand, the history is really fascinating. But you're not exactly in tears over Yankee Stadium coming down.
Well, you have to understand, they, whoever they are, already took away Ebbets Field and the Polo Grounds, for me, a National Leaguer. So why shouldn't Yankee fans have the same angst? Plus, it is an old plant, and while I could get nostalgic about it, I do know that I have to get there 4 hours ahead of a normal game in mid-season just to get a seat in the press room. So if we're inconvenienced, I can only assume that many fans are, although I do hear from fans who say, please, this stadium could have gone on forever. We didn't need it. We would put up. It's a wonderful place. Keep it. And I understand that point of view.
But so much history. It's just amazing. Here, May 14th, 1967, the great Mickey Mantle joined the Home Run Club with hitting his 500th in Yankee Stadium. Legend in his own right. Yankee announcer Mel Allen had the call.
Three balls, two strikes. Mantle waits. Stu Miller is ready. Here's the payoff pitch by Miller to Mantle. Come on, there she goes! Mickey Mantle has hit the 500th home run, and the score at the end of 7 complete innings, New York 6, Baltimore 4.
Boy, there it is. So much history in this place. We're going to hear a lot of it in this hour. Andrew Zimbalist, okay, I mean, it's not the original 1923 structure right now. 74, 75, it was rebuilt like crazy. And yet this one comes down, and it is by no means the first and surely not the last. We're here in Boston where Fenway Park, small and old and marvelous, still goes strong. Why is Yankee Stadium coming down?
Well, the bottom line, of course, is economics, but there were some structural concern issues. You might remember several years ago there was part of the roof that came down. Fortunately,
it 500 pound piece, as I recall.
Yes, yeah, so fortunately it was when a game was not being played, so as I recall anyway, nobody was injured by it. But the Yankees, as a result of the physical deterioration of the structure, the Yankees were spending more and more money every year doing maintenance and upkeep. I think that the figure had gone up to over $10 million. And they had some structural assessments made by engineers, and it didn't look good. They felt like whether it was going to come down in 2009 or 2011, it was going to have to come down sometime in the near future, and it was important to commit to doing something that would that would recreate the feelings and the style of the old ballpark, which is what they've tried to do at some enormous expense, by the way.
Yeah, but it's not just the fact that, yes, it was falling down. That might be time to replace it. But there are economics here that are playing out all over the country.
Sure, sure. You know, since 1992, when Larry Lucchino and the Baltimore Orioles built Camden Yards, and they changed the model for baseball stadiums because the previous wave of construction had been in the 1960s and 1970s, and that was a wave of cookie-cutter stadiums. It was during the automobilization and suburbanization of America, and they put those stadiums out in the suburbs. And the stadiums all pretty much looked the same way, and they were surrounded by mammoth parking lots. The idea was people were going to drive to the ballpark and pay $5 or $10 for parking, and then they'd go into the ballpark and spend all their money there because they weren't near any retail outlets. It was surrounded by a parking lot. That was the 1960s and 1970s version. And then Larry Lucchino and the Orioles come along in 92, and they say, well, there's a better model. Let's bring the ballpark back downtown. Let's put it next to the business community so we can attract the business community into the ballpark at night. We can sell luxury boxes and club seats and season's tickets. And if we can gentrify our clientele, then the value of our advertising and signage and sponsorships will all go up. And it worked in Camden Yards. The annual revenues back in the early 90s for the Orioles jumped up $30 million and more. And as soon as they did that successfully, everybody else wanted to gentrify and have new stadiums. And so there was a stadium wave. And the Yankees are actually coming at the very end of this stadium wave. But to be sure, the Yankees are expecting to generate $100 million of additional revenue or somewhere in that neighborhood. And they'll have more luxury boxes, although, by the way, not that many. 50, I think the number is 57 or 58 luxury boxes, a smaller number than in other new ballparks. And the reason is because they reason that the luxury boxes are removed from the field and the real fans want to be closer to the field. So they have a lot of fancy seats, premium seating that are at field level rather than more luxury boxes. So they have a slightly different model. But, yeah, the model here is we want to generate more money. The Yankees last year paid $110 million in revenue-sharing money to the Major League kitty, and they paid another $30 million-plus in luxury taxes. So they have to run just to stay in the same place.
They've got some bills to pay. Philip Best, we want to hear you on how this whole movement affects cities. But George Vesey, first, just on what's going to be there, you've seen the plans for the new Yankee Stadium. It'll just be right across the street from the old one, so almost the same location. No, there will be no shortage of retail outlets in what you've called Yankee Land, George.
Exactly. The stadium refers in a lot of ways to the traditional stadiums, and outside that, there are malls and concourses where people will be able to buy their expensive brand stuff. I mean, I'm a throwback fan who used to slip a couple of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches into my pocket and bring my kid to Shea Stadium or whatever. And even my kids thought that was a little passé. But nowadays, the whole idea is to consume extensively, and I guess it works because I've been in other places. Atlanta, you know, your grandson can run out and have some fun doing something else for an inning or two, and then come back to see. It's all part of the packaging. Everything's more expensive.
So what they've got here is a sort of modern-looking stadium, and then around it, a big area of retail, and around that, a kind of an old-fashioned-looking baseball reference, I don't know, wall, George.
Right. The wall, it's enclosed, which, of course, is, I suppose, a reference to outside, keeping the people out and the smaller number of fans. Maybe Mr. Zimbalist can explain the economics to me. These stadiums get smaller rather than bigger. More people, but they don't want the $7 fan. They want the $400 fan. So there's all that. But there is a wall, and then there's the space inside for the people with the tickets to go in and spend more money. And that is just the model. They're going for the high-end fan. And when people say to me, well, what about, you know, have some sympathy for the common fan, you know, you're very elitist in saying it doesn't matter if they tear down the ballpark. My point is that the Yankees and the Mets are both showing that they are going essentially for the elitist, for the rich fan, and that the poorer fan can't get his hands on tickets and essentially isn't wanted.
Philip Best in South Bend, let me just come to you for a second.
Sure.
We've got a break coming up, but what about the architecture here? Are we headed in a good direction with stadiums, stadia in this country or not?
Well, if you'll pardon the reference, my sense is that the stadiums that have been built in the even in the last 15 years are essentially stadiums on steroids. And it's interesting the comment that was made about the smaller seating capacities, because that's true. We are seeing stadiums today with smaller seating capacities, but they are much larger building footprints. So all of that new construction that's taking place is housing activities that are extraneous to the ballpark itself.
Well, is shopping and eating out still extraneous to the ballpark? Is it really? I mean, isn't that part of what's being sold as part of the baseball experience, Yankee Land?
It's definitely being sold as part of the baseball experience. I guess the question is whether that's better than the kind of model for urban baseball parks where it was a complete urban experience and not just something internal to the stadium itself. But the reasons for this, as have already been discussed, are economic. But I think there's a question about what it represents with respect to the actual quality of the experience and also the quality of our cities.
We'll come back and look at exactly that and much more. Here's U2 in 1992 in Yankee Stadium. Many more have been there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the end of Yankee Stadium, Shea Stadium too, and how ballparks and the world of baseball are changing. George Vesey is with us, sports columnist for the New York Times, author of Baseball, A History of America's Favorite Game. Andrew Zimbalist is here, professor of economics, Smith College, follows baseball economics inside and out, author of Equal Pay, Title IX, and Social Change, and In the Best Interests of Baseball, The Revolutionary Reign of Bud Selig. Philip Bess is with us from South Bend, Indiana, follows architecture there, a professor of architecture, author of City Baseball Magic. Unbelievable history in Yankee Stadium. Let's listen to just a little bit of it. Here we are. 3 months after Adolf Hitler annexed Austria, June 22, 1938, German boxer Max Schmeling and U.S. boxing great Joe Louis duked it out at Yankee Stadium. Of course, Schmeling ended up knocked out. Here's NBC's Clem McCarthy with ringside with the call.
Right to the body, a left hook to the jaw, and Schmeling is down. The count is 5, 6, 7, 8, the men are in the ring. The fight is over on a technical knockout. Max Schmeling is beaten in one round.
The time, 2:04. First round, referee stops it. The winner and still champion, Joe Louis.
Just picture it there in Yankee Stadium, a kind of victory over Adolf Hitler's man on that night, that summer night, 1938, 1957, July 20, 100,000 people in Yankee Stadium to hear Billy Graham call sinners to repent. It was the largest crowd in stadium history.
Who is on the Lord's side? Let him come unto me. Tonight, I want to tell you before you leave Yankee Stadium, you too shall have to choose, because there is no neutral ground concerning Jesus Christ.
The Lord and Yankee Stadium. And here, Lou Gehrig played 14 seasons for the Yankees, then diagnosed with a disease that would eventually be named after him. On July 4th, 1939, in Yankee Stadium, he bid farewell to an adoring crowd.
I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. That I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for. Thank you.
Lou Gehrig in Yankee Stadium. Joe Vesey, Andrew Zimbalist, Philip Best with us. Let's take a call from North Franklin, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. What do you know?
Well, I've got a lot of fond memories. I'm 67 years old, so my memories of the Yankees go way back.
Yeah.
I became a fan basically when I was a 6 or 7 year old playing with my toys on the floor while my mother was ironing, listening to the Yanks, Tommy Hendricks, Joe DiMaggio, 1947, 1948 on the radio.
Mm.
And then going to some games as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old with my grandfather in New York, we would, at the end of the game in those days, you could walk through the, you could walk out through the field to get out of the stadium. And we would go out onto the field. I would step on first base and then walk out through center field towards the monuments, which were in center field at that time.
Right on the field.
Right. And wow. I would stand for a moment in the spot where I knew Mickey Mantle stood and be him for about 10 seconds.
Yeah, about 10 seconds is right. Incredible.
And then go by the monuments and take a look at them and go out. So there's a lot of great memories. In fact, I'm going down to the stadium tomorrow to see a game.
Well, Steve, let me ask you the truth. Do you care then that that stadium's gone and there will be a new one there? I mean, don't the memories transfer or maybe not?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. I really believe that that the stadium could have existed with maybe a few repairs as it is now. They fill it up all the time. I mean, they drew over 4 million last year. But I understand the times, and there are so many stadiums built today that have a lot of added accessories, which I don't feel need to be there, but other people do, I guess. So, you know, some of it will transfer. The Yanks will do their best to make a transfer, but I'll always have mixed feelings about it.
Yeah, Steve, enjoy the game down there today and all this season. Thanks for calling. George Vesey, he mentioned 1947, remembering listening to the Yankees and headed in not long after that. I read you saying that's the year you first went to Yankee Stadium.
It's the year I first went, the last game of the season when Babe Ruth gave that famous talk that you now hear. Of course, I was also around for, you mentioned my birthday. I was born on the day that Lou Gehrig gave his farewell speech.
No kidding.
Wow.
So, been involved in baseball ever since. Your caller will be reassured. I'm looking at renderings here,
yeah,
of the new Yankee Stadium, that the monument area, and there is a fatherly, motherly, child-looking trio standing in front of monuments with other things, you know, prettier, newer, blah, 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 but essentially standing on that red warning track and looking at the monuments, presumably after a game or before. So that will go on. They are certainly giving all kinds of references. I have found, as much as I want to be old-fashioned and nostalgic, I have found that the Yankees, in particular, because they have so much history, are being able to translate a lot of that and represent it and being fair. I mean, it is what they sell. Of course, the other model is what the team in Boston has done, which is to keep that old place. And I look forward to going up there a week from today with
Fenway Park,
because I love Fenway Park. And it's a wonderful place, and they have done the opposite. They have kept the footprint, the ballpark, the narrow little neighborhood right by the expressway,
yep,
and they have gussied it up and made a ton of money by adding this and that and raising prices, but you still go into the same place. And I guess if I had to choose, I love what Boston's done because Boston's such a great city, and I can understand what the Yankees did in the Bronx.
You sure feel the magic when you're sitting in there. You couldn't be any closer, unless, of course, you're way out in the cheap seats in right field where you get a crick in your neck looking left the whole time because you're facing, what, the green monster. I mean,
well, it doesn't work in some ways, but I once sat in the bleachers in right field for an opening game, and Fred Lynn hit a home run that got bigger and bigger as my son and I sat there in the right field stands, and the ball went one section over. There's no better way than to be sitting in Fenway Park at about noon on opening day on Patriots Day to see a ball coming at you into the stands.
Yeah,
George, we have to meet up at Fenway Park next Friday. one of the things that everybody has to remind themselves is that the monuments used to be in center field in Yankee Stadium. Mm. They used to be on the field. Center field wall used to be 461 feet away from home plate. And when the stadium was redone in 74 and 75, they were put behind the left field wall. Now, that's fine. But if we're going to get nostalgic about being in center field and standing next to the monuments, we have to remember that that's been gone for a long time. And the stadium, in fact, was gentrified. Not completely, but it was gentrified in the makeover in 74 and 75, and the turf has been changed, and the grass has been changed, and now they're moving it across the street. So I think that somebody who wants to access the feelings of going to the stadium in the 1950s still can do it to the same extent that they've done it the last 30, 34 years. But the other thing that I want to emphasize is this. George Vesey is absolutely correct when he says that there's a catering to the high-income clientele. But the truth of the matter is that that's happening all over professional sports, and that it's been happening at Yankee Stadium for the last 34 years. The Yankees, in fact, I think, need to be complimented here because they will have 40% of the seats at the new ballpark that essentially are going to be priced the way they are right now. They're going to still have 5,000 or 6,000 bleacher seats that are priced $12 to $14. What they're doing that's different is at the very top end, and I think people have read about this in the New York Times and elsewhere, at the very top end, they're getting all the market will give them. In fact, they're getting less than the market will give them because they have, for instance, have these legend seats that are right on the field between the dugouts that are going to sell for $2,500 a game. And when they put those on the market, actually they haven't even officially put them on the market, but they're sold out. They're sold out, and the buyers have to make something like a 10-year commitment. They could have gotten a lot more for those seats. And that's the model that's all over professional sports these days. And it's a model really that's flowed out of what I was mentioning before, the Larry Lucchino model of bringing the ballparks back down and accessing the business community.
We're going to talk about whether it means better ballparks. Just can't get away from the history here, though. Yankee Stadium, a year after you were first there, George, Babe Ruth puts on his uniform for the last time. Then in 1948, 2 days after his death, he was 53 years old, Babe Ruth's body lay in state at the main entrance of Yankee Stadium. More than 100,000 mourners went by. Kind of an incredible image. Let's go to Daniel in Somerville, Massachusetts. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I do go back a bit myself. My father took me to my first baseball game back in the Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, Whitey Ford era before I became a Mets fanatic.
Okay.
And I have two words to say about this. Penn Station. New York City has had a long, kind of disastrous history of tearing down magnificent buildings and then grieving about them for decades afterward. And I wondered, first of all, if there was any serious government argument, New York City government argument against the plan as it stands. And also, as baseball games get more and more expensive, I'm glad to hear about the plan to keep $12 seats.
Yeah.
As they get more expensive, they always talk about African Americans not being a big part of the game in recent years. Native African Americans, if that's a term I can use, from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And when poor city kids can't afford to go to a ball game in a big league stadium, there's a really direct relationship between how inspired they are to become baseball players in their future. So I just thought I'd throw that out as a subsidiary point.
Yeah, Daniel, they're both good ones. I'll go to them. Philip Best, first to you on this last point. With your city baseball magic, I mean, is it still working with the kind of parks that are being put up, the kind of ticket prices and luxury box profile? What about Daniel's concern that, kids who don't have the scratch just aren't showing up and aren't falling in love with the game?
Well, I think that's a completely legitimate concern, and somehow baseball has to figure out a way to deal with that. I certainly appreciate Andrew's description of what the Yankees are trying to do to make that accessible. I know that in Chicago, I'm much more familiar with the scene in Chicago. The Cubs remain very active, to get kids from all over out to the park, and they're also active in local neighborhoods. But I want to go back to a point that Andrew made, though, about this experience of the fathers and their children, or the parents and their children out on the playing field, out by the monuments, and the difference between the new and the old, and the suggestion that it's not that different. What's not possible is for any Yankee fan of whatever income level. Now, it will not be possible for them to go out onto the same place that was the same grass that was trod by, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Yogi Berra, Joe DiMaggio, in that same location. And, I want to suggest that really is a kind of cultural loss. I think that the comparison to Penn Station is a good one. I think that, and it's interesting. I don't have any angst about Yankee Stadium. My loyalties really and affections lie with Wrigley Field, and they lie with Fenway Park. But if I were a Yankee fan, this would be very painful.
Let's take a call from Bob in Halifax, Massachusetts. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. Seminal moments. 6 years old, going to Yankee Stadium with my mother on Ladies' Day. The ladies could take their kids to the Yankee Stadium and the Polo Grounds for nothing during the Depression.
Wow, ladies did.
Watching
wow.
the babe, number three, yep. go around those bases for a little kid was something unbelievable. The other ones was watching Sugar Ray Robinson beat Joey Maxim in a fight that it was 104 degrees. The referee had to be taken out of the ring at the fourth round. It was so hot.
1952, and, June 25.
I wouldn't remember that, but I was there.
Sugar Ray and collapsed from heat exhaustion in the 14th round, I'm reading.
14th round, yep.
Wow.
And he had won the fight. And the other one, huge. I was there with my dad. He knew some press guys, and we were sitting beneath the press boxes at Yankee Stadium when the Yankees were, or the Giants were playing the Washington Redskins. And the word came down from the box above, the press box, Pearl Harbor has been attacked. And nobody knew what the hell it was. No one in that, among the people we were surrounded with, well, what's that? But that was during that game that message came over the box.
Well, pretty terrific. So what do you think, Bob, about it going away? Does it matter to have the same structure to you or not?
Sad memory. I mean, a great memory, sad moment. Same thing with when the Brooklyn Dodgers got bounced out and sent out to California by that guy who cared little about the fans. It was all money. He left Brooklyn with the greatest fans in the world. And, this is business, and I guess we have to face it. But, no, Yankee Stadium, as a kid, as I grew up, going there to see the ball games myself, it was cheap. You could get, today, you can't take your kids to a game without spending $200 or $300.
Yeah, yeah. Bob, the great memories, and we appreciate your call. A lot of Yankee fans tuned in on this front. The Yankees, announcing this week that during opening night this week, they arrested two fans for trying to steal bunting. People want a piece of the stadium before it goes away. Lon Trost, Yankees chief operating officer, said there will be no leniency for fans trying to take a piece of history. I don't know, George Vesey, you've written that, you think of Yankee Stadium as a hard place with the kind of Steinbrenner meanness around it.
Well, that's from the point of view of somebody who grew up as a suffered mightily at the hands of the Yankees. And people have sussed out that I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan and probably transferred some of that to the National League. So given the fact, I think we're allowed to root in sports, even in subliminal ways. I mean, Rudy Giuliani, when he was mayor, could wear his Yankee cap on his head, and it was really okay. It's one place in the world where you can at least have some feelings and admit them. So, yes, I grew up not suffering from the Yankees. And it is not a nice place in a lot of ways. When you go to Shea Stadium, you wander into the ballpark, and there's some little old guys looking at your press pass. And not that they don't inspect your bag and all the stuff they have to do these days,
yeah.
but it's like, hey, how you doing? How's it going on? What's going on? And you go to Yankee Stadium, and it's grunt, grunt, grunt. Stone faces, miserable people, people who are probably nice in their real lives. But the Steinbrenner meanness, when he was the king sitting up in his counting house, watching through binoculars to make sure everybody behaved and was up to speed on things, there's a meanness that goes through the place and a coldness that I can't get out of my bones.
Yankees fans, what do you say?
With the Yankees beating up on my Dodgers.
Yeah, hold the thought, George. Andrew Zimbalist, Philip Best, please stand by. Speaking of Shea Stadium, here's the Beatles there, and it's coming down, too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the end of Yankee Stadium, Shea Stadium 2, and how ballparks and the world of baseball are changing. Both those coming down as new ones go up after this season. George Vesey with the New York Times is with us, a sports columnist there. Andrew Zimbalist at Smith College joins us, author of In the Interest of Baseball and May the Best Team Win. Philip Bess is with us from South Bend, Indiana, professor of architecture there and author of City Baseball Magic, talking about Yankee Stadium. Let's go to Montreal, Canada for a caller. Stuart, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just like to speak from the perspective as of a huge baseball fan, a man who grew up with the Montreal Expos. One of the Expos catchers moved into right next door to me as a kid, so I had a lifelong bond with the team. And
lucky you.
And obviously, saw its demise with quite an emotional reaction that I had to seeing the team go. But I have to say that, you know, speaking as a baseball fan and seeing the finances, the role that the finances of modern baseball played on the demise of the Expos, it's very discouraging for me to see teams that are what I like to call the second tier of baseball, and the way they suffer, not necessarily financially anymore, because Bud Selig has done a great job of making sure that all the teams make money, but just in terms of sort of the water cooler talk that used to be what baseball was in America and in Canada to a certain degree.
I mean, it's skinnied down to too few teams who are really in it. Really in
that's it. That upper crust of five teams that everybody concentrates on. And you know, if the World Series doesn't have one of those major teams in it, who talks about the World Series? If I'm not mistaken, I understood that a World Cup soccer event actually outdrew a World Series event in the last few years. As somebody who loves baseball and has followed it all my life and had roots in the game and played it a little bit, it is very discouraging. And, of course, go Expos.
Stuart, thank you. George Vesey, what do you say? If you don't have a ballpark on steroids, you're not in the conversation. Do you buy that, George?
Well, first of all, your caller is shocked that a World Cup, the world's most popular sport, outdrew a baseball game.
That's
another thing. There's so much competition in sports these days between the web and cable television. I mean, I'm a soccer guy as well as baseball, and I get my fill of soccer as much as I want from overseas and domestic. And so there really is a huge competition. I can understand them maximizing when they make money. As far as we talked before, you mentioned you had the Beatles at Shea Stadium, and nobody's talked about nostalgia for Shea Stadium. And even though I'm a Queens, Long Island guy and a Dodger fan, I have no nostalgia for Shea Stadium. I can understand what everybody says about Yankee Stadium, but Shea Stadium was a dump. The only problem I have with it, the Wilpons are doing a great job of building it with reference to Jackie Robinson Rotunda, reference to the Polo Grounds, reference to Ebbets Field.
Yeah.
The only thing wrong with it is that they have a corporate sponsor with the name of a bank that can't even handle a transfer of an IRA account. Looks like they're going down the drain. And what's going to happen when that bank goes down the drain following Bear Stearns, you know, next week or whenever it does? What's going to happen with them with that corporate name? But that's a side issue, maybe.
In reference to what the caller was saying about the decline in competitive balance in baseball, two things need to be pointed out. First of all, competitive balance in European soccer is much worse than it is in American sports, and much more inequality. Teams like Manchester United dominate year after year after year. In terms of baseball's competitive balance, if you look at it going back 60 or 70 years, there's been a very steady improvement. And it's, as the caller referenced, there's been a slight further improvement since the revenue sharing system.
But since we're on stadiums, do you think that stadiums have something to do with that? The splendor of the facility and the competitiveness of the team, if you look at it, Andrew?
Well, there's certainly a synergy. If you're in a bigger city, as the Yankees are and as the Red Sox are, if you're in a bigger city, there's a certain synergy that you can get out of building a new stadium that you can't get as readily in say, Kansas City. So the new stadiums can exacerbate the revenue inequalities. But to go from there to the issue of competitive balance is, in fact, rather complicated. And as I pointed out, the Yankees got hit with a $110 million revenue-sharing bill last year, and the Red Sox paid over $70 million. So when you're successful in baseball these days, you have to transfer a good deal of cash to the poorer franchises.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation from New York. We're joined by John Swansburg, associate editor at Slate Magazine. He spent 5 years touring Major League ballparks. He's been to every ballpark in the country except a couple of three. John, thanks for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
So what set you out on your every park pilgrimage, and what do you see out there? Is it a pretty picture?
Well, the pilgrimage started, I think, mainly as an excuse for a friend who was on the West Coast and I, who have been on the East Coast, to have an excuse to get together every year and see some baseball games. And we thought that we could try to do all 30 major league parks over the course of 5 years. I did 30 parks over the course of 5 years, but because so many teams have been moving, I haven't gone to all 30. The Expos actually have been a particular thorn in my side. We went up to Olympic Stadium in Montreal. They then moved to D.C. to RFK Stadium. I went down there. And, of course, now last week they opened up this new park. So I have to scratch that one off, and the White Sox and the A's have also eluded my grasp. But speaking on this point about small market teams, one of the things that I've noticed, and I think we haven't maybe touched upon enough in this discussion, is how many stadiums have been replaced in the last decade and a half. I think of myself as something of a stadium optimist. I think I'm sort of closer to George in my opinions, in that I love the old stadiums. I grew up in the Boston area. I love Fenway. But I also love the new parks, and the new park in Pittsburgh, PNC Park, has a gorgeous view of the Allegheny, has a wonderful, you know, Roberto Clemente Bridge leading to it. It's a terrific place to see a baseball game. But one of the things you notice when you start to go to a lot of these parks is how many of them are new and how many of them have been built by the same firm.
HOK Sport out of Kansas City.
Exactly.
And Yankee Stadium, the new one, will be built by the same outfit.
Designed, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I like what HOK does. There's a reason they get the contracts. They're very good at what they do, and they did Camden. But at the same time, the same way when you read a great novelist you fall in love with, you know, when you get to that seventh or eighth novel, you start to notice they're using the same metaphors over and over again. And
you say if you walk into Coors Field now, you're going to be thinking about Camden Yards. You can't help it. The references are all there.
Exactly. There are certain things that they repeated, you know, and some of those are great, and some of them after a while get annoying.
What jumps out at you as consistent things you saw around the country?
One of the things that I find slightly irritating is the desire to have this quirky outfield. This is something that, you know, fans who go to Fenway Park know very well, that Fenway Park has the Green Monster in the short porch and left. And, you know, that's a result of it being built so long ago and the limitations that were existing on that plot of land. Camden Yards sort of brought back this idea of having the quirky outfield, even if you didn't have a limitation in your ability to build a new field. And now I feel like every HOK stadium I go to has some weird element in outfield. You know, I remember going to the park, Minute Maid Field in Houston, and there's a little hill in center field. It's just, you know, I just started to roll my eyes at a certain point.
This
presumably
is not
in Houston,
true. Not true of the new Yankee
out.
Stadium.
It's like mini golf.
Field, yeah. Exactly.
Well, you know, this is Philip Best.
Yes, Philip.
That raises an interesting point about these stadiums, because the big difference between the new urban ballparks today, the new downtown stadiums today, and the ones that were built in the era of Fenway Park and Wrigley Field, there are a couple of things. One is that the older parks were really, in a lot of ways, designed from the outside in. That is to say, they were constrained by city blocks. They were located in neighborhoods.
Shoehorning them in there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's that shoehorning them in that gave each of these parks their different, often gave them their different outfield playing configurations. As it happens, Yankee Stadium had eccentric dimensions for different reasons, but certainly in the case of Fenway, certainly in the case of Wrigley, certainly in the case of Ebbets Field, these places were all, there was a reciprocal relationship between the neighborhood that they were in and the site that they were on and the constraints that were put on the stadium. Every new stadium today is designed from the inside out. There are no external constraints. They are programmatically driven, whereas the older stadiums had to accommodate both the site and a program. The newer ones are completely program-driven, and fortunately, they've started, HOK and other stadium architects have started to be more sensitive to opportunities in new stadiums to make visual connections to the city, and I think the park in Pittsburgh is a great example of that. But HOK, you know, my observations of their work over the years is that they have to be pushed in order to do something well. They will sort of fall back on what they've done. It requires some effort on the part of the owners. And actually, I'm kind of shocked that what they're proposing for Yankee Stadium they're trying to replicate Yankee Stadium without replicating Yankee Stadium. It's the same thing that they tried to do in Boston. Before the new ownership took over, there was a plan for a $650 million new stadium built on a site adjacent to Fenway Park. Mm.
that was going to increase the seating capacity by, you know, up to 45,000 and you know, have a huge footprint. But they were going to keep the exact same playing field configuration, which is bizarre because the playing field configuration of Fenway Park is entirely a function of its being located on an idiosyncratic urban block. The new proposal had nothing to do with it. In the same way that the new proposal has nothing to do with the configuration of Yankee Stadium's playing field, in the new proposal has nothing to do with the site and has everything to do with trying to capitalize on the nostalgia.
Of course, nothing shoehorned about Yankee Stadium as it is. May 22nd, 1963, a great big Mickey Mantle's game-winning 11th inning home run off Kansas City A's right-hander Bill Fisher. Hit near the top of the 108-foot-high facade in right field, bounced back on the playing field. That was the closest a fair ball ever came to being hit out of the stadium. John, I've just got you for another few seconds. I don't know, that great big pilgrimage you took at the end of it. Any less enthusiasm for the game or watching it?
No, not at all. Quite the opposite. I'm as enthusiastic as ever and probably more. Although one thing that I find myself noticing, which is kind of odd, is that because, again, getting back to this point about how many stadiums are new and built by the same company, I found along the way that I started having enthusiasms for stadiums I wouldn't have thought I would have liked. For instance, last summer I went to Minneapolis and went to the stadium there, and that is one of the most maligned stadiums in all of baseball. It's an indoor park. It's a total eyesore. But it's different. It wasn't built by HOK. It wasn't built in the 1990s, and there's something charming about that, and I felt the same way about even Tropicana Field in Tampa Bay, another much maligned stadium. Looks terrible on television. It's much better in person, and it's an interesting architectural, effort, and it's just not like what I'm used to seeing, you know, in Colorado, in Pittsburgh, in Detroit, in Texas, both Texas stadiums. So
I think that Tropicana Field is an HOK job.
Oh, is it? Oh, that's right.
80s.
It's one of their earliest ones, right?
Yeah, that's right. Because they had built it to lure the White Sox away from Chicago. That's what
lived and learned. John Swansburg with Slate Magazine joining us from New York. Three more parks to go. What do you still have to see, John, before you've seen them all?
I have McAfee Coliseum in Oakland, U.S. Cellular in Chicago, and the Nationals Park, which I'm hoping to get to sooner rather than later. Hopefully this season sometime.
Good luck. Go get them.
U.S. Cellular.
That's a great thing.
Okay, there's advice. John, good luck on the road.
Thanks for
being here. Let's take a call.
Tour.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's take a call from Peter in Casey, South Carolina. Casey, no less. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hey, gentlemen. How are you doing?
We're good. What do you see, Peter?
Well, I was a season ticket holder when Atlanta moved from Fulton County Stadium to Turner Field. And it went from an all-purpose stadium, which was a round, you know, situation where they could do just about any event they wanted to. And then the Olympic Stadium was built specifically with baseball in mind. So the viewing experience with Turner Field is it was designed for baseball, and it's just wonderful. There's not a bad seat in the park. The other thing I liked about it is when I had my kids at Fulton County Stadium, about the only thing I could do was sit there and watch the game, and I had to feed them all the time. But with Atlanta, with the Turner Field, there was something they could do when they got bored with watching the games. And to this day, they're still good, avid sports fans in terms of going to something in person.
Peter, we love it.
It's an important point that he's making.
Yes.
You give up some nostalgia, but nobody's really emphasizing the amenities and the comfort that you get in these new ballparks. The seats are pointed towards home plate.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have foul poles and posts and blocking your view. You get to walk to a whole slew of different men's rooms food concession stands. There are larger concourses. Now, that's part of the experience, too, and it's certainly something that needs to be recognized.
Let's get one more call here. Raymond in Wayland, Massachusetts. Raymond, you're on the air.
Yes, I was wondering what the take there was if the Romans 2,000 years ago were so short-sighted enough to tear down the Colosseum.
Hey, okay. George, what do you think? Yankee Stadium is the Colosseum we're losing.
They didn't have time to tear down the Colosseum. I suspect that other events took over. Plus, they were going to let time take care of it. One of the great thrills is to walk into an old place like some of the arenas around Rome, even when you can walk in at night and do a jog around them, you feel like you're in an ancient place. No, we're going to lose that from the Yankee Stadium, but I say that there's been enough loving reference in the new place that they are going to be able to give you the feel of it. And as Derek Jeter said the other day, it's only 100 yards away. It's not that far for the ghosts to go.
The ghosts can make the trip. Wonderful. And we got the Roman Coliseum on our minds to go out with, but Yankee Stadium will be all gone. Shea Stadium, too, and new stuff coming up and coming up soon. It's been wonderful talking with all of you. I'm so grateful to you for being with us. Philip Bess, out in South Bend at Notre Dame's School of Architecture. Professor Bess, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Andrew Zimbalist, it's always great to have you with us out at Smith College in Northampton. Thanks for joining us.
A lot of fun, Tom. Thank you.
And George Bessie, we appreciate your memories. Not too treacly for you, we hope.
Oh, maybe I'm treacly.
Maybe. We don't think so. Great to have you, George. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. Always a pleasure.
George Bessie, author of Baseball, A History of America's Favorite Game. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Chelsea Mayers, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Jamie Katsoufis and Ping Huang, our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I ever get back. Let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.